Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, June 11th. I'm your reader, Erin. The first article on the front page, Iowa Western Staff, Others Discuss Ideal School Presidential Candidate by Tim Johnson. The profile of the ideal candidate for president of Iowa Western Community College began to take shape Wednesday as people provided input at several public forums. Forums were held in Council Bluffs, morning and evening, Clarinda, and Harlan Wednesday. Input gathered will be combined with responses to the college's online survey to inform the molding of the profile today of the Presidential Search Committee. The Board of Trustees will meet later today to approve a final version. The online survey went well, said Julie Golder, Vice President of Search Services for the Association of Community College Trustees. We received over 100 responses, which is fantastic, she said. Golder facilitated the discussions and asked attendees for opportunities and challenges the college will face in coming years, what qualities and characteristics the candidate should have, and what qualifications the person should have. Quote, the Board of Trustees all understand the decision we're going to make in the next few months is the biggest decision we're going to make during our time on the board, Board President Brent Sirgist said at the outset of the first forum. This will truly be a national search because of ACCT's reach across the country to literally every community college in the nation, end quote. The opening forum Wednesday morning at the Art Center at Iowa Western was attended mostly by staff members, with just a few members of the public present. Tom Gilmore, Dean of Enrollment Services, said enrollment has generally been declining over the past few years at Iowa Western and other community colleges in Iowa. He noted the college has expanded career technical education opportunities and said it should do the same for arts and sciences. I think I'm doing what we might be able to help enrollment, he said. Roger Upman, former Dean of Student Services, who left in 2005 to become a consultant for the Bureau of Community Colleges and Career and Technical Education at the Iowa Department of Education, also commented on CTE. I think they are very valuable programs, but you need somebody who's going to be in charge of fundraising, he said. These programs are very expensive. Upman also commented on the credentials a candidate should have. They must have a community college background, he said. They must have worked at a community college. Marge Welch, Dean of Academic Affairs, took that a step further and said the person should have experience as a college president. There is really a lot they're going to already have to know and be able to act upon, she said. Welch said the president will have to work closely with the Iowa Department of Education and should be ready to question policies on regulations that are not in the interest of community colleges. Laura Mendoza, Director of Academic Initiatives, said the candidate chosen needs to be approachable and have a strong financial background and be innovative and learn from other colleges. A couple others also said the president needs to have a good background in business or financial matters. Several people said the person should be able to work with legislators on both sides of the aisle and be a strong advocate for community colleges. A couple attendees said the candidate should be someone who engages and is visible in the community. One said the person should be someone who is willing to travel and reach out to people in other regions. One person said she thought the next president should be someone who has had experience with a diverse student population. Golder said many of the comments echoed responses to the online survey. She said the search team will also talk to people in the community, screen applicants, and recommend 3 to 5 candidates to be finalists for the position. Only the names of the finalists will be made public, she said. The finalists will participate in open forums where the public has an opportunity to ask them questions. Sirgist thanked attendees for their input. Most of these I think we had thought of, but there were several things that hadn't crossed my mind, he said. I would say we're all kind of on the same wavelength. There were several dozen people who attended, which pleased Sirgist. I'm very happy with the turnout, and I'm very happy with the comments, he said. Golder said many college presidents are reaching retirement age, but also said Iowa Western should be able to attract good candidates. There are many positives that will attract high-quality candidates, she said. This is a great community. There is a high quality of living here. You're near a metro area, and this is a stable, well-run institution. The next article on the front page, Iowa eases virus rules on bars, restaurants. Pottawatomie County reports 15 new COVID-19 cases by David Pitt and Mike Brownlee. Iowa bars, restaurants, theaters, and other businesses will be able to pack in more customers beginning Friday under a proclamation Governor Kim Reynolds announced Wednesday that she said reflects a decline in the coronavirus pandemic. 3 weeks after Reynolds allowed such businesses to open with a 50% capacity limit, she ended the restrictions as long as establishments practice social distancing and ensure additional hygiene practices. Swimming pools, senior centers, and adult daycare centers also may open if they follow public health guidance, Reynolds said. Results such as the consistent downward trends in positive cases and hospitalizations that were experienced for the last month allows us to confidently take additional steps forward, further relaxing restrictions and reopening businesses in a measured and responsible approach that's driven by data, she said. The governor eased restrictions as state health data shows an increase of 7 deaths in about 340 cases since Tuesday. Reynolds said eliminating the 50% capacity restrictions will allow businesses the flexibility to adjust specific operations to meet the needs of their customers and employees. Locally, an additional 15 Pottawatomie County residents have contracted COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus. Pottawatomie County Public Health reported the new cases on Wednesday, which include 13 Council Bluffs residents, along with a Carter Lake and Traynor resident apiece. Two of the cases are epidemiologically linked, and the others were tested between June 2nd and June 9th. 8 of the individuals are ages 18 to 40, 5 of them are 41 to 60 years old, and 2 of them are 61 to 80 years old. Including epi-linked cases, Pottawatomie County Public Health reports 452 cases in the county. Of those, 226 are men and 211 are women, according to statistics provided by the department. The hardest hit age range is 18 to 40 with 173 cases, followed by 41 to 60 at 145 cases. There have been 72 cases among adults 61 to 80 years old, 35 among children 17 or younger, and 12 among adults 81 or older. According to coronavirus.iowa.gov, 410 county residents have tested positive out of 5,124 cases for a positive rate of 8%, back down from 8.1% on Tuesday. Pottawatomie County Public Health said 239 residents have recovered from COVID-19, 5 individuals are hospitalized, down from Tuesday, and 187 individuals are self-isolating. Based on contact tracing investigations, 126 Pottawatomie County COVID-19 cases are the result of community spread. The department said it continues to conduct contact tracing investigations for each COVID-19 case, and if a risk to the general public is identified, the agency will publicly identify the location and communicate any actions the public should take. The department has said daily, COVID-19 is spreading in our communities. Individuals should take precautions to protect themselves, stay home as much as possible, limit travel and shopping, and practice social distancing. Wash hands and disinfect frequently touched surfaces multiple times per day. If you are sick, stay home. Statewide, 22,551 Iowans have tested positive out of 203,227 people tested, according to coronavirus.iowa.gov. There have been 630 COVID-19 deaths in the state, while 13,628 Iowans have recovered from the disease. The next article on the front page, No Butter Cow This Summer at Iowa State Fair Canceled, by Scott McFedridge, Des Moines. Hold the pork chop on a stick and get a butter cow rain check. This summer's Iowa State Fair was canceled Wednesday due to concerns about the coronavirus, marking the first time since World War II that the annual gathering won't be held in Des Moines. Without comment, the State Fair Board voted 11-2 to cancel the fair, which typically caps an Iowa summer with an 11-day run in mid-August. The fair is the biggest attraction in Iowa, usually drawing more than 1 million visitors who check out the butter cow, buy pork chops, or countless other food, typically skewered with a stick, and stroll through 445 acres of barns, carnival attractions, and even a campground. Officials in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Indiana have also canceled their fairs, though state fairs are going ahead in some states, including Nebraska, South Dakota, and Kansas. Jerry Slater, the state fair manager and CEO, said the decision was necessary to protect the health of fairgoers. More than 22,600 Iowa residents have tested positive for the coronavirus, and more than 630 have died. While the decision of the Iowa State Fair Board today will certainly come as a disappointment to many, the board determined that holding a fair in accordance with current health guidelines related to COVID-19 wasn't feasible, Slater said in a statement. Slater said the board was also influenced by surveys that indicated the likelihood of a much smaller attendance if the fair was held. Because most of the fair's revenue comes from the annual event, Slater said the organization would need to reduce expenses. The last time the fair was canceled was from 1942 to 1945 during World War II. The fair board has already scheduled the 2021 Iowa State Fair for August 12th through the 22nd. The last article on the front page, Market Season 2020, Farmers Market Council Bluffs opens today, by Mike Brownlee. Farmers Market Council Bluffs begins this afternoon. The 2020 season will start with social distancing measures in place at 4:30 p.m. at Bayless Park with more than 20 local vendors, according to market organizer The 712 Initiative. The Farmers Market will run through September 24th from 4:30 to 7:30 p.m. every Thursday in Bayless Park. Visiting our market is a great opportunity to support a local vendor, as all products come from less than 30 miles away, Jeff Snow, director of the programming and events at the 712 Initiative, said in a release. The produce goes straight from the farm to your hands. Due to the current guidelines set by Governor Kim Reynolds, the vendors at Farmers Market Council Bluffs will only be selling farm products and food at the market, 712 Initiative said. These guidelines also prohibit entertainment and other social activities at the market, meaning there will be no organized play-based wellness activities or live music this season. The farmers market has guidelines set in place for both their vendors and patrons. Vendors are required to wear a mask at their booth, demonstrate hand sanitation, limit food and product touching, prepare food for takeout only, and limit employees at their booth. Patrons are encouraged to also wear masks, maintain a 6-foot distance from other patrons, point to the products they want, and use card payment for the produce. FMCB is a program of the 712 Initiative and is presented by CHI Health Mercy Council Bluffs. The market can be found on Facebook and Instagram at Farmers Market CB. Our next article, Black Lives Matter Protests Rally at Iowa Capitol, by David Pitt of the Des Moines Associated Press. Black Lives Matter protests rallied inside the Iowa Capitol on Wednesday, shouting, "I can't breathe, injustice now," in an effort to convince lawmakers and the governor to take action on the issue of racial inequality. About 24 protesters peacefully gathered at the public space between the main entrances of the House and the Senate. At one point, protesters banged on Republican Governor Kim Reynolds' office door, and a few later spoke with her staff about how to schedule a meeting. "That's all they got left is to hide from us. All they got left is their bureaucracy," said Matthew Bruce, the local group's leader. "This is a disaster. This is a complete disaster for the state of Iowa, for the Republican Party, for the party of Kim Reynolds, for the Democrats too, because I don't see them here. They could be right here on this door trying to fight with us." Bruce said that if he were to speak with Reynolds, he would tell her to sign an executive order to reinstate voting rights for felons who have completed their sentences. "She could do that, like right today. She could do that. That's what I would bring up, something she could do today," he said. Senator Brad Zuon, an Urbandale Republican, met with Bruce and promised to work on issues the group raised. "I'm sick and tired of lip service," Zuon told Bruce. "I'm more interested in solving problems with some of the injustices going on. I'm open-minded, but I'm just one senator." While Reynolds didn't meet with the group Wednesday, she said she has met with community leaders and lawmakers on potential legislation that could be passed this year. "I made it very clear I'm committed to sitting down and having conversation, most importantly, listening, and talking about what we need to do to continue to move forward," she said. Democrats and advocates for minority groups have proposed a package of legislation that includes banning police from using chokeholds and making it difficult for police officers with bad records to get hired by another force. Reynolds has asked lawmakers to begin the lengthy process of passing a constitutional amendment to restore ex-felons' voting rights. Republican senators insisted that the legislature first approve a law requiring restitution to victims before the restoration of voting rights. Reynolds signed that bill last Thursday. The constitutional amendment is eligible for debate, but hasn't yet passed the Senate. Moving to the local and weather page of the Nonpareil. Chance of rain takes halt through weekend by Emily Schiebel. On Tuesday night, the Council Bluffs area saw 3.4 inches of rain, according to Brett Albright with the National Weather Service in Valley, Nebraska. The heavy rains caused some street flooding in the city and power outages on both sides of the Missouri River as storms moved through. As of Wednesday, there are no chances of rain through next week. Today, temperatures will be back in the 80s, according to the Weather Service. A wind from the west may reach 10 miles per hour at times. Tonight, the low is in the lower 60s with a northwest wind. The weekend temps will tend to stay near 85. This week's forecast, according to the Weather Service, today, sunny with a high near 84. Tonight, clear with a low around 60. Friday, sunny with a high near 88. Friday night, mostly clear with a low around 62. Saturday, sunny with a high near 84. Saturday night, particularly cloudy with a low around 62. Sunday, partly sunny with a high of 84, breezy. Sunday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 66. Monday, mostly sunny with a high near 89. Monday night, partly cloudy with a low around 65. Our next article, Fire Department Cancels Fire Hydrant Parties by Susan Payne. Hydrant parties in Council Bluffs have been canceled this summer. The Council Bluffs Fire Department announced the cancellation Tuesday in an effort to reduce the chance of spreading COVID-19, the disease caused by the novel coronavirus. With public safety at the forefront of its decision, the fire department stated, "This comes as a hard decision, but we must look out for the safety of public and reduce the spread of the coronavirus." Our next article, AmeriCorps Recruiting for Wabash Trace Nature Trail by Mike Brownlee. The Wabash Trace Nature Trail is looking for a little help. Southwest Iowa Nature Trails Project Incorporated, a nonprofit that maintains the venerable 63-mile trail, is taking applications for two AmeriCorps members to help provide assistance on the trail. Swint said it was recently informed that the organization was approved for the Iowa COVID-19 Recovery AmeriCorps program. Applicants are being sought to fill two positions who will each serve 450 hours over the course of 16 weeks. The part-time terms were designed to provide flexibility in weather and existing schedules, the organization said. Qualified applicants may begin as soon as June 15th. AmeriCorps members will receive a living allowance of $3,780 for completing 450 hours of service, divided evenly across the term of service, Swint said. AmeriCorps members will also receive a Siegel Education Award worth $1,612.43 when a term has been successfully completed that can be applied to existing debt or future education costs for a variety of technical training, post-secondary, and graduate programs. AmeriCorps members age 55 or older can transfer the education award to a child or grandchild. Student loans determined for or forbearance or forgiveness opportunities may be available depending on the type of student loan. Child care assistance is also available if needed. As for the job description, AmeriCorps members will assist trail crew and volunteer members with a variety of trail maintenance issues, but the majority of the tasks will be focused on intensive tree trimming and vegetation management for the entirety of the trail. Members must be at least 17 years of age, hold a valid driver's license, and adhere to the AmeriCorps terms of service. Chainsaw experience is preferred, although not required. Quote, "We are so excited about the chance to have the Wabash Trail participate as an AmeriCorps Hope site. It will be a huge benefit to the trail," Rebecca Castle with Swint said. "The entire trail is 63 miles long, and unfortunately, we don't have the manpower or budget to be proactive in keeping the many trees that line the trail cut back to a point where they are out of the way for trail users and maintenance equipment until they become a problem. This will help us play catch-up on some of the trimming and take care of some of the hangers and learners that may just be waiting for the next storm to become an issue. It's also a great opportunity for the AmeriCorps members. Our work crew and volunteers are some of the most knowledgeable, dedicated people that I know, and the members will have the opportunity over the next 16 weeks to learn from their extensive experience," end quote. Anyone interested in the positions may email or mail a resume and brief cover letter to the contact mentioned below. This could be an excellent opportunity for anyone who is retired, furloughed, temporarily unemployed, or on a seasonal break from school, Swint said in the release. Participation in this AmeriCorps program will allow members to keep any unemployment benefits they are currently receiving because it is a service and training opportunity, not employment. Service will be completed on the entire length of the trail, but members will be headquartered out of Malvern or Shenandoah. According to Swint, the Wabash Trace is a former railroad corridor that was rail banked and turned into a recreational trail for bicyclists, hikers, runners, bird watchers, and other nature enthusiasts. The trail is now 30 years old, and although regular maintenance is done, there are some major projects that will need to be done to keep the Wabash Trail in good condition for the next 30 years, extending from Council Bluffs through Mainola, Silver City, Malvern, Imogene, Shenandoah, and Coyne to Blanchford at the Missouri boundary. The trail is 63 miles long and has over 70 bridges. With the exception of about 4 miles of asphalt or concrete at Silver City, Malvern, and Shenandoah, the trail surface is a crushed limestone. If anyone has any questions about the trail or would like information about the AmeriCorps service opportunity, please contact Swint via Facebook at Wabash Trace, email at wabashtracenaturetrail@gmail.com, visit the trail website at wabashtrace.org, or call Castle at 515-210-0269. Moving to the opinion section, we need more data about how the coronavirus spreads to know what's risky and what's not, by Rajiv Bahira. The 19th century physician turned epidemiologist John Snow discovered that water, not air, was the cause of the 1854 London cholera outbreak simply by asking victims about where they got their water. We are more technologically advanced now, but we could still apply old-school epidemiological tools to the data that public health departments routinely collect and get better answers about where the infections from the novel coronavirus happen. My public health professor defined epidemiology simply the study of the causes of disease. Diseases like COVID-19 have immediate causes, but like the coronavirus that emerged last year, but they also have an array of causes behind the causes. Understanding underlying causes, like where and how an infection spreads, is a key for stopping any disease. Because the virus spreads easily and through people without symptoms, we can't completely isolate the risk of getting COVID-19 to just some places or activities, but the risks of getting and spreading the disease are not the same everywhere, at every time, for everyone. And the epidemic involves we might expect increasingly localized outbreaks. We also heard about many high-profile outbreaks. They occurred at nursing homes, meatpacking plants, choir practices, and prisons. That tells us that particular places are higher risk. So far, we've just been speculating about where, but answering these kind of questions is what epidemiology can do well. Uncertainty about risks will get in the way of America reopening. A recent Associated Press University of Chicago poll tells us that over half of Americans fear getting a haircut, going shopping, or visiting a friend. Better facts about the location of the bigger risks might help people feel more confident about lower risk activities. This information also tells public health officials where to target prevention efforts. States and counties collect detailed data on every COVID-19 case, but so far they haven't been using that information to say where risks are higher. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services is now reporting COVID-19 cases and deaths from licensed nursing homes. Otherwise, neither states nor counties nor the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have been telling us how much different living and working conditions contribute to the spread of the disease. One study in Asia found that work-related transmission played an important role in the early phase of the outbreak, with healthcare work driving and retail sales being riskier jobs. The reason this study was possible is because researchers were able to easily extract the case data from 6 different Asian countries. We have the same opportunities in the United States now. The case report forms completed by doctors contain a wealth of information, like the type of place a person lives, their work, whether they had contact with someone they knew to be infected, or whether they traveled recently and where, if so. These cases reports eventually get funneled up from counties to states to the CDC. The work of contact tracers provides additional clues. The tracer's main job is to get an infected person's contacts and quarantine. We can learn from the tracer's work how many contacts are being reached and how quickly, giving us a sense of how many infectious people are circulating among us. Tracers can also learn about how and where people made contact. Was it a household, at a bar, a church, a school, a grocery store, a public swimming pool? Were people sharing a meal, working together, or walking in a park? This rich data is an opportunity to more precisely understand our risks and to more precisely target our resources. What's needed is collecting this data well, organizing it, and making it useful to people. Countries like Singapore are reporting the exact location of every cluster of COVID-19 infections. Privacy advocates in the United States might object to this, but gleaning epidemiological insights doesn't require revealing any private information. One challenge is that today each county collects data on COVID-19 in its own way. We need the information in the same language, in real time, and publicly available. So far, very little risk factor information appears to be making its way to the CDC. Calls for better information on ethnicity began months ago. The CDC director recently announced requirements for counties to report more facts, but he gave them until August to deliver. We should expect every bit of useful information to be collected. August is too long to wait. All things considered, organizing and sharing this data should be one of our easier challenges. It's not like we need to invent a new kind of ventilator. This is the country of big data and technology titans. Understanding why and where COVID-19 spreads may not lead us to the cesspool where the disease breeds, as it did for Jon Snow, but it may provide enough guide spots to lead us to safety. Health departments have been collecting this data for months already. It's time to bring it together and use it. Your views. The leadership of our governor. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds has apparently decided that she, and she alone, can decide when and how to share information with her fellow citizens on viral infection levels at Iowa's meat processing plants and senior centers. She apparently judges that it is appropriate to allow commercial interests to have a significant voice in the timing and content of any announcements. However, this elected public servant obviously considers timely warnings to the local residents most likely to be directly affected by any looming health hazards to be a lower priority. This governor seems determined to show the same lack of focus and empathy so eloquently and consistently demonstrated by her mentor in the White House. Furthermore, she seems equally committed to getting back to a business-as-usual economy as quickly as possible with only minimal regard for health risks. Does her cavalier attitude and autocratic operating philosophy really seem the best for Iowa during this lethal viral pandemic? That was by Dean R. Prestemon from Ames. Invisible but not forgotten, telling the stories of the forgotten faces in the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm a direct support professional, DSP. That means I support people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, IDD, to live independently in supported community living homes with two or three roommates, rather than being regulated to a large state-run institution. I work for an organization here in Council Bluffs called Crossroads of Western Iowa. I help people with differing abilities with personal hygiene, household chores, finding and maintaining work, voting, maintaining relationships with friends and family, and so much more. Most of the time, we operate invisibly, intentionally remaining behind the scenes so the people we support can be seen for who they are and integrate into their communities. But amid the COVID-19 pandemic, we haven't just been invisible, we've become the hashtag forgotten faces. As a DSP, I'm used to my workforce being overlooked. Long hours and low pay have led to turnover rates in many professions more than 50% well before the pandemic. But now, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has failed to allocate CARES Act funding to Medicaid providers, leaving many organizations without enough resources to weather the storm, let alone return to normal operations after the pandemic has subsided. We need Congress, including Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst, to act. They can help alleviate this situation by exercising Congress oversight authority to ensure Health and Human Services stops overlooking people with IDD in the Medicaid-funded community-based service providers on which they rely. That was by Misty Smith of NEOLA. You are listening to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, June 11th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. James Allen Faust. James Allen Faust, age 72, passed away June 8, 2020 at his residence. Jim was born May 2, 1948 in Quincy, Illinois, and graduated from Waterloo West High School in 1966. He proudly served his country in the U.S. Navy and was united in marriage to Barbara Hyatt on June 28, 1980. Jim began with the Council Bluffs Fire Department on April 1, 1974, and served this community, retiring as an engineer on May 5, 2005. He also owned Jim Faust Signs. James was preceded in death by his parents, Robert and Mary Faust, sister Marilyn Spouth Gordon Balvens, brother John Faust, in-laws Everett and Velda Hyatt, sister-in-law Denise Dole. James leaves to mourn his wife of almost 40 years, Barb, son Jeff, daughters Amy Faust, Roanne, Sarah Faust, Schulder, and husband Sean, four grandchildren, Corbin and Ava Roanne, Sophia and Sawyer Schulder, many nieces, nephews, brothers, and sisters-in-law. Visitation will be Friday, 4 to 8 p.m., funeral services Saturday, 11 a.m., with COVID-19 restrictions in force, all at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Council Bluffs Honor Guard to Stand Guard. Family will direct memorials. Larry Lee McGee. Larry Lee McGee, age 73, passed away June 3, 2020. He was born on March 2, 1947, to the late Clyde and Daisy Stillwell McGee in Council Bluffs. In addition to his parents, Larry was preceded in death by brothers Donovan, Max, Rex, and Jimmy, sister Betty, grandson Evan. He is survived by his children Troy, Kim, Corey, and Christy, several grandchildren and great-grandchildren, sister Leona Perdue, and a host of other relatives and friends. Memorial service is 2 p.m. on Sunday, June 14th, 2020, at the Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home. Memorials may be directed to the family. Dale Ann Good. Dale Ann Good, 61, passed away Sunday, June 7th, 2020. She was born August 10th, 1958, in Council Bluffs to Dean and Deanne Chapin Good. Dale Ann loved spending time with her children, grandchildren, and watching her cop or crime shows on TV. In addition to her parents, she was preceded in death by her brother, David Good. Dale Ann is survived by her children, Crystal, Paul, Keith, Stephen, spouse Stephanie, grandchildren, Paige, Zach, spouse Natisa, Tracy, Sydney, Caden, Kiefner, and Donald, brother Mark, spouse Martha, and her stepmother, Marilyn. Dale Ann also left behind many other relatives and friends. Celebration of life will be held at a later date. Stephen D. Sears. Stephen D. Sears, age 28, passed away June 1st, 2020. He was born on November 17th, 1991, in Omaha, Nebraska. Stephen graduated from Lewis Central High School with the class of 2010. He was a journeyman electrician with Local 22. Stephen is survived by his parents, Steve and Lori Sears, sister and brother-in-law, Beth and BJ Watkins, grandparents, Lita Sears, Kathy Schneider, Ron Wilson, nieces and nephews, Gavin, Vivian, Marie, and Kyle, his beloved dog, River, aunts, uncles, and cousins, and a host of other family and friends. Memorial visitation is at the Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home from 5 to 8 p.m. on Friday, June 12, 2020. The family will direct memorials. And now moving to the sports page, Senior Corps Looks to Lead Thomas Jefferson by Derek Noheron. With a solid core of five seniors, the 2020 Thomas Jefferson baseball team is looking to make some noise and improve upon last year's 6-18 record. However, first and foremost, those five seniors, along with the rest of the Jackets, are just grateful for the opportunity. After missing out on many senior staples, a baseball season is a welcome reminder of normalcy. They're extremely excited, those kids. Have worked hard all through the offseason in the weight room and with their speed and agility. Thomas Jefferson head coach Tom Giles said, "They already lost graduation and prom, so I tell them that they've already overcome a lot in their lives, more than a lot of people will. You only make yourself better by overcoming things." The core five seniors are Ryan Stingspring, Grant Merck, Tucker Rowe, Jared Thompson, and Nathan Newton. But make no mistake, this is no ordinary senior season. As everyone gets used to a new normal, high school baseball in Iowa is no different. In many ways, it will be a test case for fall sports and those that follow. "It's a little more work as a coach, but it is what it is," Giles said. "We're lucky to even be able to play the season, so we have to follow the protocols as far as social distancing and taking temperatures before we check into practices. We want to make sure that everyone is good so that everyone is safe." Giles feels his seniors are equipped to handle this year's unique challenges. "My five seniors are all on the same page in terms of pushing each other to be better and taking care of what needs to be taken care of," Giles said. The biggest known entity on the mound is senior Grant Merck, who pitched the most innings last season for TJ 47.7, going 2-3 with a 2.79 ERA. Grant is the up ultimate competitor. He wants to win in everything that he does. When he gets on the mound, he executes and throws strikes. He does a good job holding the running game and is just one of the best at competing, Giles said. He tries to push himself to get to the next level, and he's going to get an opportunity to play beyond high school ball. Fellow senior Stingspring is also an option on the mound, pitching 26.7 innings last season with a 1-1 record and a 2.36 ERA. However, much of the pitching and playing duties will be decided based on performance and how guys respond in game situations. We're probably going to do a lot of pitching by committee this year. We have a good mix, but our five senior leaders are going to be our everyday players in the lineup. We also have some younger players like Tyler Huey, Hunter Reba, and Robert Wood that will hopefully step up into some bigger roles this year and take on some more of that core. Those guys are side by side with the older guys working hard and hopefully all gel and get better. Stingspring is also a fire starter offensively last season, hitting a team best .378 while trying Merck and the team lead with 12 stolen bases, a team-high 29 runs scored. In short, he is the catalyst for the TJ offense. Ryan is kind of the core of the offense. One of the things I've always liked about him is that even when he was younger, he was one of those guys who makes everyone better, Giles said. Ryan is also a kid who can get frustrated, but that's the life of a hitter. We have to keep him understanding that you have to flush an at-bat or flush a play and move on to the next one and go back to battle. TJ opens their season on Monday with a doubleheader against Sioux City North with games at 4 p.m. and 6 p.m. Our next article on the sports page, Donahue, new normal of local sports set to begin. I think it was somewhere between my 17th rewatch of The Office and the final two episodes of The Last Dance that it hit me. Sports, on all levels, but especially locally, have been gone for far too long. Hard to believe nearly three full months have passed since Iowa prep sports have gone on hiatus thanks to a global pandemic. Thankfully, the wait will be over soon. Summer sports are officially back Monday, and soon the path to normalcy will commence, but it won't happen unless the necessary precautions are taken. The Iowa High School Athletic Association and Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union have put together guidelines for safety of coaches, players, and fans. If a whole season for both sports is going to happen, guidelines must be followed. Similar precautions will continue to be taken here at the Nonpareil. The sports staff has been lucky enough to work remotely for much of the COVID-19 pandemic. We will continue to do so in the immediate future and during the start of the baseball and softball seasons. Much like the current rules in place to ensure a softball and baseball season, this will be a mild adjustment. Derek and I will be reaching out to city and area coaches with information on how to call in scores and game recaps. Coaches or administrators are still encouraged to email game information to sports@nonpareilonline.com. Under normal circumstances, reporting summer game results in time for our print edition is a challenge. Games can run long, which can make meeting a 10:45 deadline extra difficult. If that's the case, we still want that call. We can get that recap into our online roundup. We are anxious for sports to return, to feature Council Bluffs and other area athletes, and to get back to what we enjoy doing most. Telling stories. First pitch is right around the corner. We can't wait to tell you who won safely. The next article on the sports page, what's next? NCAA finalizing plan for extended college football preseason by Ralph D. Russo of the Associated Press. After the pandemic wiped out spring practice for most major college football teams, an NCAA plan to extend the preseason by 2 weeks could help coaches and players make up for the lost time. The NCAA's Football Oversight Committee expects to finalize a plan on Thursday to allow teams to conduct up to 12 unpadded slow-speed practices, also known as walk-ons, during the 14 days before the typical preseason begins in August. Teams will be permitted up to 20 hours per week of what the NCAA calls countable athletically related activities during those extra 2 weeks, leading into a normal 29-day preseason practice schedule. The walkthroughs will be part of those 20 hours per week, along with weight training, conditioning, film study, and meetings. Players will not be permitted to wear pads or helmets during walkthroughs, which cannot exceed 1 hour per day. Notre Dame coach Brian Kelly said the extra time on the field with a ball will be valuable for teaching schemes, but not necessarily for assessing player development. That going to be all the install that you didn't get in the spring is really going to take place during that period of time, Kelly said Tuesday. They won't be an opportunity to see skills on display. The Football Oversight Committee has been circulating its proposed schedule to NCAA members as a way to encourage feedback. West Virginia Athletic Director Shane Lyons said he doesn't expect much to change before it is taken to the Division I Council for approval next week. The council meets June 17th. I think there's been a lot of collaboration among the conferences, Lyons said. Schools have started this week bringing their football players back to campus for voluntary workouts, mostly weight training and conditioning, in team facilities. Players are being tested and screened for COVID-19 and will continue to be monitored for the coronavirus. Under the Oversight Committee's plan, this period of voluntary activities would run until about July 12th, depending on the exact date of a team's opening game. That will be followed by 2 weeks of summer access, which usually happens earlier in the year. During that time, coaches can require up to 8 hours per week of weight training, conditioning, and film study. Lyons said if any tweaks are made to the plan before it goes to the council, they would likely be made in this 2-week period. Around July 24th, the meetings and walkthroughs can begin. Then, 29 days before a team's first game, August 7th, if the opener is September 5th, the usual presentation practice period starts. Lyons said teams will be required to complete at least the 4 weeks of standard preseason before playing a game. There has been concern among NCAA officials and athletic administrators that some schools will not be able to start their preseason work soon enough to begin their seasons on time because of restrictions put in place by state and local authorities to fight the coronavirus. Those fears seem to be easing now. It all gives us a little bit of relief knowing the campuses are starting to reopen and these student athletes are back working out on campus, Lyons said. What will practice look like during a pandemic? The Oversight Committee won't be in charge of those details. Those decisions will be made at the school level, guided by local health officials, but medical experts at the conference and NCAA levels are also expected to provide guidance. Todd Berry, executive director for the American Football Coaches Association, said he would expect some coaches to segment their teams, holding multiple practices per day. Berry said when he was coaching, he would use this approach to give players more repetition and individual attention. Now it could be used to limit exposure just in a case a player contracts the virus. The ones and threes practiced in the mornings, twos and fours practiced in the afternoon, he said. Tulane team physician Greg Stewart, who is heading the American Athletic Conference COVID-19 advisory panel, said the hope is testing and screening of the players for the coronavirus will go well enough that players won't need to use face coverings during practice, but the coaches and staffs would all wear N95 masks. Stewart said, referring to the highly protective masks often used by healthcare workers. If face coverings are needed for players, Stewart said neck gaiters, stretchy scarves made of lightweight, breathable material could be the team's go. If the group is spread out and socially distanced and they're running and doing stuff like that, they don't need to have that on, Stewart said, but they'd wear it around their neck and when they come up as a group, they pull it up and cover their mouth and their nose. The last article on the sports page, Kerr Nurse Among NBA Coaches Wondering About Olympic Plans by Tim Reynolds of the Associated Press. Golden State coach Stephen Kerr was supposed to be in Tokyo for the Olympics this summer. And now he's supposed to be there for the rescheduled version next summer. Then again, Kerr isn't certain if he or anyone else from the NBA will be there at all. With the next NBA season not expected to start until at least December 1st, that calls into some serious question whether that could overlap with Olympic qualifying tournaments that some nations will need to endure in June 2021 and the Tokyo Games themselves the following month. And Kerr, who is slated to be an assistant under San Antonio's Greg Popovich for USA's basketball in Tokyo, said Tuesday that he doesn't have any idea how the schedule will work. Believe it or not, I haven't had a single conversation with Pop about that, Kerr said. And the reason is because we don't know. We've been talking almost daily now for the last couple of weeks, and before that we were speaking once every few weeks. So we haven't even had a single conversation because there's nothing to report. The U.S. is among 8 teams who have already qualified for the 12-team men's tournament at the Tokyo Olympics, which were pushed back a year because of the coronavirus pandemic. The Americans had a ton of interest from the NBA starts of this for the summer. Now, with things delayed a year, USA Basketball Managing Director Jerry Colangelo has said he and Popovich will wait until the NBA schedule plans for 2021 become certain before mapping out an exact plan to build the roster. FIBA pushed back the dates for the 4 remaining qualifying tournaments to June 29th through July 4th, 2021, meaning they would end 19 days before the rescheduled start of the delayed Tokyo Olympics. There will be 4 different 6-team winner goes to the Olympic tournaments hosted by Canada, Croatia, Lithuania, and Serbia. Toronto coach Nick Nurse is scheduled to coach Canada in that qualifying tournament, and he hopes the Olympics. But he expects the international travel is one of the last things that will return to normal, or whatever the new normal will be in a world dealing with COVID-19. So he's like Kerr and left wondering what will happen. It's complicated, is my best thought, Nurse said. I just don't know enough to tell you what next season is going to look like. I don't know. When's it going to start? I think they're talking about pushing it back, but I don't know if they're going to play games closer together. I don't think so. That's kind of a thing that everybody's been happy that they continue to spread them out and lessen the back-to-backs and all those things. But if they do that, then it's probably going to run into the Olympics, or really close to it, right? Lots of things that I don't have a crystal ball on, Nurse added. Nurse, Popovich, and Kerr surely aren't the only coaches wondering at this point. Golden State Associate Head Coach Mike Brown is set to coach Nigeria in Tokyo. Toronto Assistant Sergio Scariolo will coach Spain, and Philadelphia coach Brett Brown will coach Australia. Nigeria, Australia, and Spain have joined the U.S. as having earned Olympic berths already, along with host Japan, Argentina, Iran, and France. And at the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics, a record 46 players from the NBA participated. Had the Olympics gone off the summer as planned, even more NBA players could have been there, depending on which teams won the final 4 qualifying spots. If the 2020-2021 NBA season starts in December, that would likely mean a May finish to regular season and serious potential for a schedule collision. NBA playoffs going off at the same time as the Olympic qualifiers and perhaps the Olympics themselves. The NBA has told players that it is planning for a December start up to the season, given that this season's NBA finals once things restart next month at the Disney complex near Orlando, Florida, could last until October 12th. But the one way the NBA could alleviate the potential for an Olympic problem is to get away from the player-friendlier scheduling models used in recent seasons that greatly lowered back-to-backs and eliminated the dreaded stretches of 4 games in 5 nights. If the league did that, it could buy some time and possibly make the Olympics fit on some player and coach's schedule. they've talked to us on our team calls that it might be a condensed schedule next year, more so than in the past, said Atlanta general manager Travis Schlenk, whose coach, Lloyd Pierce, is also scheduled to be a USA basketball assistant next summer, along with Kerr and Villanova's Jay Wright. Whether that'll happen or not is anyone's guess. Until that is known, it is very much a waiting game. We're just sort of waiting to hear what the news is, Kerr said. If the news is good and we're going to be able to take part, we'll be ready to roll. And if it's not, we'll deal with that later. And that does it for today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, June 11th. I'm your reader, Erin. You can access a recording for today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. As always, thank you so much for listening and have a great day.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland, and is used today around the world, and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff, where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap, and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.